number one fan has just listened to the second time of Skylark of Space. Thank you so very much.
Go tape.
Here now the words.
Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on AnonRadio.net.
Well, cats and kittens, I am coming to you through the magic of pre-recording, because if you're listening to this live, I'm downtown having a medical procedure done, of which I will probably have more to say on a step farther out tomorrow, because, as ever with medical services in the United States, the road was not exactly clear and smooth. Despite my best intentions. But before I introduce today's selections, I have here something very interesting which arrived in my post office box the other day. That is Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. And you're welcome to write me. I look forward to your cards and letters. Now this envelope, despite being addressed not only Post Office Box 1035, but even with the ZIP plus 4, 76101-1035, which really does uniquely identify where it should be delivered to, someone at the post office has written a question mark next to the address with a black magic marker. I've no idea why. But in the upper left-hand corner of the envelope, in metallic ink, stamped is TOBE. And on the left-hand side of the envelope, there is a Buddha figure, also, I think, stamped. And then on the back of the envelope, a Dharma wheel in a sort of lilac color. Now, what does this envelope contain? Well, there is an explanatory letter dated the 24th. Please find enclosed one unique dubious artifact. No more will be made. It is a talisman from the sutra spoken by the Buddha on prolonging life by worship of the seven stars of the Northern Dipper. And then there's a created by Tobe stamp and the other half of the Bodhisattva on the envelope. So he must have overlaid the two pieces of paper and stamped them in one operation, which is quite nifty. And what is this talisman? Well, it is a rectangular piece of bright yellow paper, printed in red with an outline of the Northern Dipper and some Chinese characters which say roughly that. And I can tell that it was from Japan or passed through Japan at some point because the little Bodhisattva figures representing the stars of the constellation have the Japanese Iroha ordinals attached to them. And then for each star, there is a truly ludicrous-looking, complex Chinese character. And it is also, interestingly enough, numbered number 1037. And there's an impression of a Japanese cash coin. You can tell it's Japanese because the inscription says Eho, which is not something that the Chinese normally put on their cast cash coins. And you may ask, well, what makes this special? And the answer is that, in addition to the printing I just described to you, there is a second printing or stamping, again, Chinese characters, which I suspect are a Buddhist sutra. And the ink is very difficult to discern against the paper. I had wondered if it was perhaps ultraviolet reactive ink, but I ran my UV light over it, and it's not. But it's a very pale and faint, almost as though it was done with water or something? I don't know. But the characters are quite distinct, so one almost feels as though one is reading invisible ink. Anyway, it is quite the fascinating little item. As I say, I suspect it of being a specimen of at least two, if not in fact three, successive impressions of block printing, because the coin image seems to have been applied separately from either the main printing in red or the faint printing of what I think is Buddhist scripture, perhaps even a scripture which is explained by the diagram. Very art. The sort of thing I would expect from Tobe. Tobe does art. And I'm doubly glad to have received this, of course, because it's a sign that Tobe is recovering. Of course, he continues to do Dubious Goals Committee shows also, which is a positive sign. Art is one of those activities which frequently bespeaks a rising action. Things might not be great, but there is something good going on. Now, the remainder of today's presentation is, I'm sorry to say, not me. It is a record I bought the other day, and you're going to say, oh, well. But it's quite the interesting record. This is from a label called Sound Stories, LP601, number 4472, Flying Scotsman, Sounds of the Great Steam Locomotive in Action, with narration by Alan Pegler. Now, Alan Pegler makes one think. If you believe that it's better that society should have a moderate number of wealthy people because they get up to things that individuals who aren't wealthy just don't have the means to do, and public or cooperative bodies would never think of, then perhaps Alan Pegler, who purchased the steam locomotive known as Flying Scotsman, when it was to have been scrapped, and had it maintained and ran it in service on the railways in Britain, is as good an example as any. But of course, the other part of the lesson that I take is that he was certainly not the wealthiest man in Britain in the 1960s. The very wealthy, it seems to me, become entirely consumed by wealth itself. They can't think of anything other than wealth itself in most cases. And so they never do anything especially interesting with their money. And I'd say you're perfectly welcome to despise Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk, but at least they haven't fallen entirely into that trap. Aside from subjecting you to the best part of an hour of the sounds of a steam locomotive in operation, side one is trackside sounds, side two is footplate sounds. In actuality, there's a great deal of talk from Alan Pegler over the locomotive sounds. Not only descriptive of what's going on when you hear the sounds, but also telling the story of what he was doing with the locomotive and the trains that it pulled, and so on. Flying Scotsman holds a special place in my personal mythology because, as I've mentioned before, in the 1980s, when there was a great deal of controversy over the Thorpe plant being constructed then at the Sellafield site in the west of England, Thorpe standing for Thermal Oxide Reprocessing Plant, which was intended to handle nuclear fuel from water reactors of the American type and from the British second-generation gas-cooled reactors, the AGRs. You know, Greenpeace and allied organizations had mounted an immense campaign against it, and they managed to convince a number of prominent musical acts, including U2, to put on a whole series of stop concerts, that was what they were called, and they plastered up posters all over the place saying, Sellafield 2 will release 1,000 times as much radioactivity as Sellafield 1, which is absolutely false. The truth is that over the years at Sellafield, the Magnox fuel reprocessing plant had been tweaked to gradually reduce its radioactive discharges to the Irish Sea, which were a constant bone of political contention with the Republic of Ireland. Despite having no particular environmental effects, they were measurable, and in the world of radiation protection, measurable is all that counts. But the Thorpe plant was specially designed to reduce its discharges to a much lower level than the original Sellafield plant, even with all the modifications. But, of course, when have facts ever mattered to anti-nuclear activists? On the one hand, I can't blame a musician such as Bono of U2 for not being well informed about the facts of, say, nuclear energy, which is a highly technical field. On the other hand, I do feel the need to place a certain amount of blame on anyone who lends his name and influence to a campaign without learning the facts about it first. Be that as it may, British Nuclear Fuels Limited had the brilliant idea that to tell their side of the story, what they needed to do was to bring lots of people to the visitor center at Sellafield in a very memorable way. And so they started running excursion trains pulled by the Flying Scotsman. The west of England, the Lake District, where Sellafield is located, is such a remote area that the railways there have not even yet been electrified. And of course, just next door, as it were, to Sellafield is the Ravenglass and Eskdale narrow gauge steam railway. And in fact, at one point there was something called Cumbrian Contrasts, which was a one-day package where you would ride on the Ravenglass and Eskdale and also visit the Sellafield Visitor Center. So I think there were a lot of rail fans who went on these Sellafield Flyer, as they were called, excursions, without having any particular interest in the nuclear energy debate. Anyway, I've collected a few souvenirs over the years of these Sellafield Flyer excursions, and in fact, just the other day, I purchased, haven't received yet, a large poster with some ancillary materials relating to one of these excursion trains. I have a placemat, which was used, I suppose, in meal service, which has the slogan on it, which they used all throughout this program, "From steam power to nuclear power," which is quite amusing to me. Firstly, of course, because the nuclear power plants at Sellafield, Calder Hall, that is to say, like pretty much every other nuclear power plant, are themselves, or were, they're out of commission now, steam power plants. But also, secondly, because the Calder Hall reactors in particular, which were originally built primarily to produce weapons plutonium with electricity as a byproduct, and then sort of gradually re-engineered and retrofitted as pure power producers, were among the most antiquated of nuclear power reactors. Comparatively, the Flying Scotsman, of course, was one of the most modern of steam locomotives. So even though the Flying Scotsman was built in 1923, and the Calder Hall piles went into operation about 35 years later, in a relative way, you could say that the steam locomotive was more modern than the nuclear power plant. But enough from me about that. Here is Alan Pegler and his pet steam locomotive.
My name is Alan Pegler, and in January 1963, I was lucky enough, after about 12 months of negotiation, to succeed in buying the only unstreamlined Gresley Pacific, number 60103 Flying Scotsman. This locomotive had been, of course, the LNER number 4472, and had been built in 1922 by the Great Northern Railway, but became, in fact, the first of the LNER locomotives after the amalgamation in 1923. She was first steamed in January 1923, and therefore her maker's plate bears that year as the building date. Now, when negotiations had been completed, I was asked when I would like to take delivery, as it were, of this locomotive, and I asked if it would be possible for Flying Scotsman to work the 1:15 train from King's Cross to Leeds as far as Doncaster on the 14th of January 1963. And the sounds that you're going to hear now are the historic departure of Flying Scotsman on the last working run as a British Railways locomotive, having steamed for the LNER and British Railways no less than 2,076,000 miles. There's a distinctive noise coming up to Potter's Bar, which may also have been audible on the departure from King's Cross, and that is the fact that at this time Flying Scotsman was fitted with a double chimney. She was one of the last of the Gresley Pacific's unstreamlined variety to be modified in that way, and she was only running with a double chimney for a comparatively short time because one of the first things that I did, having purchased the locomotive, was to have the single chimney restored. History was made in April 1964 when, after again a great deal of negotiation with both the Eastern Region, the London Midland Region, and the Railway Inspectorate, permission was given for a train hauled by Flying Scotsman from Manchester to Marylebone via the old Great Central Route to go through the Woodhead Tunnel. And the only stipulation was that steam should be shut off while the locomotive and the train went through, and that an electric locomotive should be coupled onto the front of the whole outfit and should haul through both locomotive and train. And you'll be able to pick out the noise of the electric locomotive gearing, revving up, and the conrods of Flying Scotsman as she moves away being towed by the electric locomotive. Strange that it's only a few years ago, but already it's quite historic to think of a train arriving at Marylebone, steam-hauled all the way from Manchester. But these are the sounds that follow now. Flying Scotsman arriving at Marylebone on the 18th of April 1964. The return journey from Marylebone, Flying Scotsman hauled the train as far as Penistone, and the sound you hear now is of Flying Scotsman accelerating away from Northolt Junction. Before the 80 mile an hour limit had been applied to Flying Scotsman due to her age, a fairly high speed run was made between King's Cross and York, and the sound you hear now is Flying Scotsman near St. Neots running at 92 miles an hour. Autumn of the following year, 1965, Flying Scotsman was going to haul a train between Paddington and Cardiff, and it became known, unofficially, that an attempt was going to be made to beat the best steam timing that had ever been recorded between Paddington and Cardiff. And this was the only occasion on which the engine was in any way sabotaged. It's quite obvious when you listen to the sound of the locomotive running through Reading that something is rather strange. You can hear this peculiar tick on the beat of the locomotive as it's running. What in fact was happening was that the back left-hand steam chest cover was coming adrift, and here, passing Goring, the sound is perhaps even more pronounced. Flying Scotsman did get as far as Swindon and made a remarkably fast time to that point, 72 minutes for the 77 miles, but it was not possible to continue beyond that point. So a month later, the run was attempted again with a train called the Panda Pullman, which was run as a sort of consolation prize for those who had attempted the run a month before and to raise money for the World Wildlife Fund. This run was a complete success, and you can hear now the sounds recorded at Paddington Station when the locomotive arrived back on a November day in 1965.
We are sorry that transport tickets are not available for entry to platforms 4 and 5.
Keep shutting off all the way from Reading. We were running off half regulator most of the
way. You broke the record, the steam record going down.
Yes, in spite of a 7-minute stop at Swindon for water.
The following autumn, in 1966, Flying Scotsman had acquired a second tender, the object of this being to overcome the difficulties that were being encountered due to watering points being done away with. And the first long-distance run that Flying Scotsman did with a train was across country from Lincoln to Blackpool. Now that route contains, amongst other things, a very severe bank on the way up to Copy Pit Box. And here is a very fine sound of Flying Scotsman working really hard, climbing a gradient of 1 in 67 to Copy Pit. Very heavy load of this train, plus the second tender, which weighs as much as two carriages, and the gradient, British Railways insisted on the locomotive being assisted in the rear, and there was in fact a WD-280 banking at the rear of the train. This run with the double tender convinced British Railways that it was a practical proposition for Flying Scotsman to run over routes that had been prohibited for the last 2 years. So on the 23rd of October 1966, Flying Scotsman again left from King's Cross on a trip to the north, and here's a sound of her running, picking up speed in the Hornsey area. November 1967, so far as is known, for the first time ever, a Gresley Pacific, Flying Scotsman, left St Pancras Station. November isn't a very good time to run special trains, and the morning in question was a very, very misty one. The rails were very, very greasy, and you can hear the difficulty she's having in starting. In 1968, Flying Scotsman made another trip out of St Pancras, this time a highly successful one, and you can hear the locomotive now running past Elstree at considerable speed. May 1st, 1968 was perhaps the most dramatic day in all the years that Flying Scotsman had been in private ownership, because that was the day when the attempt was going to be made to recapture the events of 40 years earlier and run non-stop from King's Cross to Edinburgh. Flying Scotsman came up overnight to Hornsey and came into King's Cross very early in the morning at about 6 o'clock, and the tender was there coaled to absolute maximum capacity, and for the first time we used the coaling equipment that had recently been purchased, and you can hear the little petrol engine driving the conveyor belt and the coal being loaded into the tender. Very nearly 10 tons of coal were got on, and this was all done in the milk dock at King's Cross, adjacent to the suburban station, and when everything was ready, Flying Scotsman pulled forward from the milk dock towards the tunnel mouth outside King's Cross station, and then backed from there onto the train on platform 10. You'll hear now are typical sounds of a departure, perhaps very distinctive noises of the activities that precede the departure of an important train of this kind.
Half a minute, I'm going to test it. Half a minute.
There's no number 9 platform at King's Cross, and the present day Flying Scotsman train service was departing from platform number 8 immediately alongside 4472 on platform 10, and the distinctive sound of the Deltic at the head of that train can be heard. The departure of 4472 herself is almost inaudible because it was a very, very gentle start, so that the photographers at the top of platforms 8 and 10 could get photographs of the two locomotives, the Deltic and 4472, pulling out side by side. The 25th of May 1968 was another special occasion when Flying Scotsman was given permission to haul a train over the Forth Bridge. The train itself was unusual, as the first two coaches were a Pullman kitchen car and the Hadrian bar out of the Teestown Pullman, and it was believed at the time that this would be the last occasion when a steam locomotive would be allowed to haul a train over the Forth Bridge. Thank you. My name is Alan Pegler, and in January 1963, I was lucky enough, after about 12 months of negotiation, to succeed in buying the only unstreamlined Grizzly Pacific, number 60103, Flying Scotsman. This locomotive had been, of course, the LNER number 4472, and had been built in 1922 by the Great Northern Railway, but became, in fact, the first of the LNER locomotives after the amalgamation in 1923. She was first steamed in January 1923, and therefore her maker's plate bears that year as the building date. Now, when negotiations had been completed, I was asked when I would like to take delivery, as it were, of this locomotive, and I asked if it would be possible for Flying Scotsman to work the 1:15 train from King's Cross to Leeds as far as Doncaster on the 14th of January 1963. And the sounds that you're going to hear now are the historic departure of Flying Scotsman on the last working run as a British Railways locomotive, having steamed for the LNER and British Railways no less than 2,076,000 miles. There's a distinctive noise coming up to Potter's Bar, which may also have been audible on the departure from King's Cross, and that is the fact that at this time Flying Scotsman was fitted with a double chimney. She was one of the last of the Grizzly Pacific's unstreamlined variety to be modified in that way, and she was only running with a double chimney for a comparatively short time, because one of the first things that I did, having purchased the locomotive, was to have the single chimney restored. History was made in April 1964 when, after again a great deal of negotiation with both the Eastern Region, the London Midland Region, and the Railway Inspectorate, permission was given for a train hauled by Flying Scotsman from Manchester to Marylebone via the Old Great Central Route to go through the Woodhead Tunnel. And the only stipulation was that steam should be shut off while the locomotive and the train went through, and that an electric locomotive should be coupled onto the front of the whole outfit and should haul through both locomotive and train. And you'll be able to pick out the noise of the electric locomotive gearing, revving up, and the conrods of Flying Scotsman as she moves away being towed by the electric locomotive. Strange that it's only a few years ago, but already it's quite historic to think of a train arriving at Marylebone, steam-hauled all the way from Manchester. But these are the sounds that follow now. Flying Scotsman arriving at Marylebone on the 18th of April 1964. the return journey from Marylebone, flying Scotsman Hall the train as far as Penistone. And the sound you hear now is of Flying Scotsman accelerating away from North Holt Junction. Before the 80 mile an hour limit had been applied to Flying Scotsman due to her age, a fairly high speed run was made between King's Cross and York, and the sound you hear now is Flying Scotsman near St. Neots running at 92 miles an hour. Autumn of the following year, 1965, Flying Scotsman was going to haul a train between Paddington and Cardiff, and it became known, unofficially, that an attempt was going to be made to beat the best steam timing that had ever been recorded between Paddington and Cardiff. And this was the only occasion on which the engine was in any way sabotaged. It's quite obvious when you listen to the sound of the locomotive running through Reading that something is rather strange. You can hear this peculiar tick on the beat of the locomotive as it's running. What in fact was happening was that the back left-hand steam chest cover was coming adrift, and here, passing Goring, the sound is perhaps even more pronounced. Flying Scotsman did get as far as Swindon and made a remarkably fast time to that point, 72 minutes for the 77 miles, but it was not possible to continue beyond that point. So a month later, the run was attempted again with a train called the Panda Pullman, which was run as a sort of consolation prize for those who had attempted the run a month before and to raise money for the World Wildlife Fund. This run was a complete success, and you can hear now the sounds recorded at Paddington Station when the locomotive arrived back on a November day in 1965.
We are sorry that transport tickets are not
We've got an 80 mile an hour speed limit. You can't break a record all this time with an 80 mile an hour speed limit.
Had to keep shutting off all the way from Reading. We were running on half-regulator.
You broke the record, the steam record going down.
Yes, in spite of a 7-minute stop at Swindon for water.
The following autumn, in 1966, Flying Scotsman had acquired a second tender, the object of this being to overcome the difficulties that were being encountered due to watering points being done away with. And the first long-distance run that Flying Scotsman did with a train was across country from Lincoln to Blackpool. Now, that route contains, amongst other things, a very severe bank on the way up to Copy Pit Box. And here is a very fine sound of Flying Scotsman working really hard, climbing a gradient of 1 in 67 to Copy Pit. Very heavy load of this train, plus the second tender, which weighs as much as 2 carriages, and the gradient, British Railways insisted on the locomotive being assisted in the rear, and there was in fact a WD-280 banking at the rear of the train. This run with the double tender convinced British Railways that it was a practical proposition for Flying Scotsman to run over routes that had been prohibited for the last 2 years. So on the 23rd of October 1966, Flying Scotsman again left from King's Cross on a trip to the north, and here's a sound of her running, picking up speed in the Hornsey area. In November 1967, so far as is known, for the first time ever, the Gresley Pacific, Flying Scotsman, left St Pancras station. November isn't a very good time to run special trains, and the morning in question was a very, very misty one. The rails were very, very greasy, and you can hear the difficulty she's having in starting. In 1968, Flying Scotsman made another trip out of St Pancras, this time a highly successful one, and you can hear the locomotive now running past Elstree at considerable speed. May the 1st, 1968 was perhaps the most dramatic day in all the years that Flying Scotsman had been in private ownership, because that was the day when the attempt was going to be made to recapture the events of 40 years earlier and run non-stop from King's Cross to Edinburgh. Flying Scotsman came up overnight to Hornsey and came into King's Cross very early in the morning at about 6 o'clock, and the tender was there coaled to absolute maximum capacity. And for the first time, we used the coaling equipment that had recently been purchased, and you can hear the little petrol engine driving the conveyor belt and the coal being loaded into the tender. Very nearly 10 tons of coal were got on, and this was all done in the milk dock at King's Cross, adjacent to the suburban station. And when everything was ready, Flying Scotsman pulled forward from the milk dock towards the tunnel mouth outside King's Cross station, and then backed from there onto the train on platform 10. You'll hear now are typical sounds of a departure, perhaps very distinctive noises of the activities that precede the departure of an important train of this kind.
Half a minute, I'm going to test it. Half a minute.
There's no number 9 platform at King's Cross, and the present day Flying Scotsman train service was departing from platform number 8 immediately alongside 4472 on platform 10, and the distinctive sound of the Deltic at the head of that train can be heard. The departure of 4472 herself is almost inaudible because it was a very, very gentle start, so that the photographers at the top of platforms 8 and 10 could get photographs of the two locomotives, the Deltic and 4472, pulling out side by side. The 25th of May, 1968, was another special occasion when Flying Scotsman was given permission to haul a train over the Forth Bridge. The train itself was unusual, as the first two coaches were a Pullman kitchen car and the Hadrian bar out of the Teestine Pullman, and it was believed at the time that this would be the last occasion when a steam locomotive would be allowed to haul a train over the Forth Bridge.
To all my listeners, I hope the program you have just heard has made your day just that little bit better. I look forward to reading your cards and letters over the air. Send them to Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. The Campaign for Real Mail thanks you. If you wish to tip the storyteller and are not comfortable mailing wads of cash, you can go to paypal.me/prometheuslives. Every little bit is greatly appreciated. A recurring gift of support at patreon.com/publius_reads will be acknowledged with benefits such as individual downloadable chapters. You might also want to give my other Anon radio show a listen. A Step Farther Out. 19 UTC, Saturdays. Until next time, this has been
Hear Now the Words.